Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the one and only The Charlotte Line. This is Dr. John. So glad to be with everybody tonight. We got, of course, our co-host. I got to say something funny. You know, we're all stuck inside the house. And I remember when I was a kid and it was raining and we didn't have the internet. And I was told, well, what do we do? It's Saturday and it's raining. And I was told, make my own fun, which meant get out of my parents' hair and let them watch television. So we're going to make our own fun tonight right here in beautiful downtown Internet City. I'm coming to you from Myrtle Beach. And in Studio G, the one and only Zach Beechler. How you doing tonight, Zach?
I'm here. I'm tired, but I'm here.
You're not tired now. You're energized because we're going to talk about, for 88 minutes, we're going to talk about racing. So that's great. Well, glad to have you here. And from beautiful downtown Des Moines, Iowa, the sun and fun capital of Iowa. Brady, can we say that? Here's Brady Van Sickle. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, not too bad. Just kind of getting used to the whole quarantine life. I mean, that's kind of the new norm, I guess.
Oh, I got a great idea. I need to make some stickers that say quarantine life. That's a great idea. Anyway, yeah, I'll see what I can do about that. Anyway, it's good to be here with you guys. You put a smile on my face. Last night, I tell you what, if it weren't for hosting podcasts, it would be the world's worst thing. I found out something unusual and crazy last night. We were doing Murder 123, my podcast on serial killers, and I found out that Charles Manson, the incredible, infamous murderer, serial killer, he actually was a songwriter, and the Beach Boys, that great singing group from the 60s, the Beach Boys, actually recorded one of his songs on one of their albums, and it was actually the B-side of one of their big hits, and I think it was Good Vibrations, actually. So kind of unbelievable, the things you learn when you start delving into history of serial killers and race car drivers. But anyway, it's good to be here. Zach, what have you got for us tonight? Tell me something good.
Well, John evidently hasn't been paying attention to what's happened the past 48 hours in the racing world.
You are right. I have been working on my programming skills. So what's happened?
Well, a very well-known, well-liked driver kind of lost quite a bit in the past. Yes,
I was afraid somebody might have died and I didn't know. Yeah, oh yeah, I knew about that.
Well, I mean, Kyle Larson's career died, but
Yeah, that's true. Well, unfortunately, Kyle Larson during this weekend's exhibition race at the Monza Speedway, which was put on by Landon Castle, who thought it would be fun to run an iconic racetrack for fun. No damage, no cautions, you go and you just go. Well, unfortunately, Kyle Larson dropped an unfortunate word during that caused not just an uproar on Twitter, Facebook, but also an uproar in the racing community. He is now, as of yesterday, he had lost the majority of his sponsor's connections, and as of today, he's been let go from his ride at Jeep Canassi Racing. Now, with no racing going on right now, there's no telling what will happen to that ride, whether it's going to go to Ross Chastain, who him and Jip Ganassi have been becoming good friends, and even letting Jip's even let Ross run a couple of his cars. But the big thing that's worried people is, what's Kyle going to do? NASCAR suspended him, and he has to go through some sensitivity training before he is able to even come back to the track, let alone race. So it's been an interesting 48 hours since the incident happened and was caught on Twitter.
Sensitivity training. Boy, that's a real 70s kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's a real unfortunate deal. If you've been keeping up with the saga, like Zach said, it's started on Sunday night, and it's gotten to the point where now Kyle Larson has joined the millions of others Americans in the unemployment line. And honestly, it's it's just a really disappointing situation, especially for the sport as a whole. I don't know about you, Zach, but growing up, the constant thing that was always brought up whenever I told people I was a NASCAR fan is there was always those generalized stereotypes that NASCAR is just a bunch of racist rednecks, you know, just a white man's sport. And if you're not a white straight male, then you have no business being at the track. And if you've been to any racetrack around the world, you know that's just not true. And that's been a stereotype that NASCAR, unfortunately, has really had to deal with for the bulk of their history. And they've done an amazing job, especially in the last couple decades or so, really trying to put new programs in place. They started the Drive for Diversity program, just really encouraging more people to take a look at the sport and really diversifying the look of the garage area. And that, to me, is what's most heartbreaking and just devastating about this whole situation. It's not just the fact that a driver, a representative of the sport, you know, made a remark that has no business or place being in any form of civilized conversation, but he's a graduate of that very program. Kyle Larson, a member of the 2011 class for the Driver Diversity. And that, to me, is where the most heartbreak comes, because a driver like Kyle Larson should know better. And I said it on my Instagram earlier today that I really genuinely hope that this isn't the end of his career, but I really think that not only Kyle, but we as a fan base, we as a sport, really need to take a hard look at why this incident occurred. And we need to do a better job of keeping each other accountable, because that kind of behavior, that kind of language just has no place. And I really hope that he and the rest of us can learn a lot from this situation and grow as people and as a society. Because if you turn on the news right now, we have enough divide in the world. We have enough, you know, hatred amongst the world that we got to find a place where that stops. And we got to find a place where we can all unify. And by allowing, you know, language like that and that kind of rhetoric in, that's just going to further create that divide and further drive a wedge between us. And I just really hope that we all learn from this, and I really hope that it's not the end of his career, and that he goes through the sensitivities training, really takes a hard introspective look at where he stands on his personal levels and comes out stronger from this. Because as I relayed to a couple fans today, you can't have punishment without the redemption, otherwise the punishment doesn't teach you anything. There's nothing to be learned there if all there is punishment and no way or chance of redeeming yourself, because without that redemption, it was all for naught and no one learned anything. So I really hope that that's our biggest takeaway going forward, and that we can all come together, not only as individuals, but as a sport as a whole, to really try and lift each other up and really try and make NASCAR the inclusive place that it really should be, because it's not just the stereotypical good old boy that people think of that attends these races. People from all backgrounds, sexual orientations, gender identities, races, they all come together for that one thing that all drives us to the racetrack, that love of going fast, to pushing a man-made machine beyond its limits. That's what unifies us, and I really hope that we focus in on that during this hard time and really, really take an introspective look at ourselves and how we all can do better to try and eradicate just this utter ridiculousness that still persists in our country, you know?
Well, it definitely is. The best way I like to put it is it's given us a black eye. You know, we can't heal from this, but it's given us a big black eye, because a lot of people have the stereotype, because in the early parts of NASCAR history, yes, unfortunately, there was that racism and there was that hardship. A great person to look at is Wendell Scott. He had a NASCAR victory, and it was technically never given to him properly. He didn't get the trophy. He didn't get the kiss. He didn't get the recognition until after he was scored two laps down, or he was scored as, you know, finishing third to that race. But in all reality, he finished two laps ahead of everyone. NASCAR had, you know, since then, I believe it was in the early 2000s, if not late 90s, reconciled and said Wendell Scott was the official winner of this race, and ever since it has been, you know, putting a memorial up for that, at the track with stickers for Wendell Scott, and even at the NASCAR Hall of Fame. Like you said, this is a real black eye to the Drive to Diversity program that Kyle had graduated from. And a great person in the NASCAR community, Bill Lester, even pointed out that, you know, this is not good for him. You know, over the years, NASCAR has changed that, changed everything, even from taking the Confederate flag away. And if you showed up to the track with a Confederate flag and traded in, they'd give you a brand spanking new American flag to wave. But unfortunately, there's still some people that are reluctant to give that up. You know, I really do hope this isn't the end of Kyle's career as well. I'm hoping that he'll take this to heart. He'll either take either the rest of the season off, or he'll, you know, do some more focus on something else, whether it's the dirt stuff he runs, comes back, or does maybe some training work with some teams, maybe helps some teams, like be a lead development or something for GMS or some other team. But it's a real hit in the gut to, especially me as a fan that, you know, watches NASCAR and doesn't matter who, you know, what your color skin is or your sex orientation or anything. If you win the race, I'm going to be proud of you because you've done something not a whole lot of people have ever done in their lifetime.
Exactly.
I want to make a comment, if I may. I've dealt with a lot of musicians. Really superstar musicians. And the ones that have a career that lasts their entire lifetime realize that every second they're awake, from the time they get up in the morning to the time that they go to bed, they're under the microscope. And he's a star. He was a star. He is a star. I mean, obviously, he's a very accomplished man. But people have got to realize, since they're too used to being a star, and think that, and they forget that they represent themselves and they represent an entire sport. And anytime you're around anybody, that is your career. And that's the one thing that fame does give you, is it gives you a general, I mean, unless, you know, I was talking about Charles Manson, of course, that's a whole different thing. But fame gives you a career. You got to realize that from the time you wake up until the time you go to bed, you're under the microscope. And I think that's, I mean, do you guys see my point there? You've got to realize that.
Yeah.
Every time I open my mouth on a podcast, I can't show up at my best, or at least realizing that I've got to be careful what I said because I've had a bad day. In fact, I've learned that sometimes some of the best shows that I host are after problems, and I'm really watching my P's and Q's. So, yes, fame, it gives you a career. You got to be careful. You learned a tough lesson. So, you know, let's always hope that people learn from their lessons. And I think the things that you two gentlemen were talking about, you know, Zach, you were saying maybe you can do this, there's plenty of room, I believe, in our society for some redemption. You just got to earn it. Like you earned it the first time around, you'll have to re-earn it again. But, you know, usually if you can do it once, you can do it again. So we'll see how big of a person he is. That's what I've got to say. I hope you guys appreciated that. So that's what I think.
Well,
I'm done. I'm done. I'll leave my advice back, you know, out in the car now. Okay, we'll proceed forward.
Well, it's just interesting because in the past 2 weeks we've had instances of drivers losing, you know, sponsors is one way to put it. Bubba Wallace lost a sponsor for the virtual race they had in Bristol, where William Byron won. Well, Bubba wasn't having fun. And 9 laps in, he rage quit. He just quit the race. He's like, I'm done. You know, this is that. And during that time, you know, he tweeted out saying, you know, wasn't having fun, blah, blah, blah. He essentially said he just quit. And his sponsor fired him on the spot. It wasn't a big-time sponsor by any means. It wasn't one that I had heard of for him that was going to be on the Cup car when he raced, when we go back racing. It was just a sponsor for this virtual racing. And, you know, to me, and I told Brady this, and Brady, you know, we kind of, I don't want to say butt heads, but we have different opinions on it. As someone that has worked in the industry alongside the PR management, you know, side on the race team, and seeing this and seeing what Bubba had done and the public tweet about it, it brought me to, you know, that's someone I don't want to represent my brand. Yes, you know, we got more exposure, but then there's going to be people like, well, Bubba just straight up quit and you know, they fired him because of that. I can't be by that, but it's weird with no real racing action going on. There seems to be more drama, and 2020 seems to be the year of interest and hardship in NASCAR. I feel beginning at the, you know, this year when we had the very scary crash of Ryan Newman, to now the whole pandemic that is essentially not shut down, but pause NASCAR and pause a lot of teams from working, to now these virtual races were having issues with drivers from just rage quitting, which, you know, yes, it is a video game, but, you know, this is such a weird year so far altogether.
No, definitely. This is one for the history books for sure, and sometimes not in the best of ways, like you said. And I was actually talking with a friend of ours this afternoon. I hadn't talked to her in a while. We were just kind of catching up on the racing season. And what's kind of been lost in all the shuffle, especially on me, is how good of a start, you know, the Ryan Newman crash aside, how great a start the 2020 season really had. There was so much promise. The racing product was phenomenal. The short track package looked to be the fix that we were needing to really make for a good, well-rounded season, not just at mile and a half, but also at our short tracks. The points battle was looking really good. We were getting some different winners. Just all these things were starting to build up to that this really good season. And then over the course of the last few weeks, who knows where all that momentum went, because, God, it just feels like we're constantly just sinking lower into this weird abyss of normalcy that's now kind of taken hold of the country as we're kind of figuring out how to wade through the trickiness of all the news going on about COVID, trying to keep ourselves safe, keep our families safe, but also trying to, you know, keep moving forward and keep pretending like things are, you know, still, you know, the same old same, and that we're still being able to do the things that we love and enjoy. And it's just really kind of working into itself into this big old mess that we kind of found ourselves, you know?
I think, and I'm going to say it like this, in the wake that's kept happening, we will, you know, after tragedy, there's you unite. And after everything that's not just going to happen with the racing stuff, but also in the real world, we'll come back, we'll unite and be even stronger and, you know, have the community like it used to be, if not better, having, you know, family and friends and even being able to just relax again. I know, and I kind of told John this, I'm supposed to fly back home in July, and I'm hoping that happens. But, you know, it is so odd of everything that's going on right now, from the racing stuff, the pandemic stuff, and the PR nightmare that has been happening the past 24 hours in NASCAR. Right then.
No, I was just thinking. It's really interesting, you know. I deal in Comic Cons and festivals. I had 12 scheduled. Everybody was excited. Now we have zero, and it has been an interesting year. But in 20 years, we will not think very much of how different this year was. And I think we all have to realize we just have to get through it and just go on and. Realize that, you know, the South Carolina Lizard Man Festival will happen this fall now, not the second weekend in June, and everybody in the world down here in South Carolina was so excited about the Lizard Man Festival. So in 20 years, just realize let's make it a year that people don't remember for bad things. Let's try to make it a good year, because there's a lot of the year left, and a lot of great drivers out there and great people in those teams and in the pit and in
you know what I'm going to do?
What are you going to do?
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to keep my pants on. All right then.
Okay.
Okay. And
all right, never mind.
Where did that one go? Okay.
Let me just, all right, it's in the trash. But the thing is that we can look forward to, because we still, as of right now, have a prominent NASCAR season to continue. We will still have the Truck Series, the Xfinity Series, the Cup Series. Hell, we'll still even have the bounty system, the bounty on Kyle Busch for all these races. And I think people are forgetting that. Kyle Busch was dominating the trucks so much so that not just Kevin Harvick, but the CEO of the company, Gander Outdoors, puts up $50,000 to any driver that can beat Kyle Busch. Not only that, I think it's Kyle Friesen's sponsor, Harman? How do you say that, Brady?
Stuart Friesen and Halmar.
Put up $50,000 for any driver that can win the race, period. This is just, it's an interesting, you know, we still have a lot of racing to go whenever we can get it live. It won't be anytime soon, unfortunately, but we still have a very much so, a fun season ahead of us that includes races at fantastic tracks. We still go to Daytona. We'll be back there in September. Going to Talladega, Martinsville, going to Indianapolis, where we'll have the Xfinity Series running the road course. That's never happened before. And even having, you know, the trucks run Eldora, run up in Canada, run in Iowa, all the Iowa races. As of right now, we're still in a good spot. I haven't heard or seen anything, and Brady would be the one guy to tell me first off if something had changed up there.
The only thing that they're looking at doubling up on the IndyCar weekend and making it a doubleheader to try and condense the IndyCar schedule down as they're trying to reshuffle just like NASCAR is. But as far as we know, I've been in contact with the media team at the Iowa Speedway, and they're telling us that we're still planning on green flag racing once this blows over, if it does. So keeping our fingers crossed for sure up here in Iowa.
Oh, yeah, because I haven't even checked to see. I don't think I scheduled my trip during a race, which I hope not, but there's a 5% in me that's like, I kind of hope I accidentally did so I could go to a race back there.
I mean, that'd just be the perfect coincidence right there.
Just be like, hey, Dad, I'm going to Des Moines. Oh, never mind, I'm going to Newton. I'll be back.
Gotta get all racing on.
Actually, I better check that to make sure I didn't make a mistake. Iowa Speedway. But that is something, you know, of course, anything and everything that's been happening with this whole situation, we still have, you know, the race action. One thing I want to bring up, if you are a YouTube guy like I am, I love, you know, I've watched, I'd say 99% of my entertainment comes from YouTube, if it isn't coming from, like, Hulu to watch a certain show to get caught up on. NASCAR is playing a different race on YouTube, and it's staying up there just about every single day. I'm going to their channel now, but I think they just played a Carl Edwards win just today. And
yeah, the
cool
Richmond
speed.
Race in 2016 where he did the bump and run on Kyle Busch.
That's right. It's so cool because they have these full races going on. They had that one. They have tomorrow at noon, tomorrow being the 15th of April, they have Kyle Busch, Rex Dale Earnhardt Jr., the full race. If you look at it, they're doing so many full races, and it's so awesome to see that they're embracing what is going on. Yes, it's not the best circumstance, what the heck, but it's still something amazing that they're putting up all these old races, and most of them aren't even that old. 2001, 2013, 2015, it's so great. And you know, we're here going to be doing the retro rewind. Talk about races, and actually that's something me and Brady are going to have to talk about because we got to get some more races. We only have two more left in the chamber to talk about that we thought we'd talk about, and we have to come up with some more. And I got some ideas, and I bet Brady does as well.
Oh, yeah. No, and if you've never really taken a stroll down the YouTube offerings, not just the NASCAR page, but just random YouTubers, there's all kinds of full races on there. Literally, I spend hours upon hours watching old races, educating myself in the sport, you know, just really trying to take it all in. And it's my favorite thing to do, especially when I'm in my art studio drawing out decals for my cars or building a car. There's no better background noise than just putting on an old race, especially one of my favorite races that I know by heart. I mean, I'm not going to lie. There are some races from around the mid-2000s when I was a kid that I'd watch all the time that I probably have, you know, some of the broadcast words memorized better than some movie quotes because I have my favorite races, you know, and there are some races I've definitely worn out the tape recorder on. But no, if you're looking for something to fill the time, I honestly could not recommend higher because you learn so much from the sport because you can do all the reading you want. You can go look up Racing Reference all day long, but there's no better way to really understand the history of our sport and just how rich and how full it is, just the characters, just everything about it. Quite like, you know, watching these old races, especially when you start getting back in the 80s and 90s, and you get to really experience the old broadcast team with voices like Ken Squire, David Hobbs, just real stewards of the sport, the original pioneers of broadcasting that would bring NASCAR into our home, and just hearing the stories they would tell and the perspective they would bring, it's unlike anything. And I've grown up with racing broadcast my whole life, and there's just nothing quite like the insight that Ken Squire would bring or the history that David Hobbs would fall back on. It's just so captivating, you know, just tuning into these old races. And it doesn't really even matter to me that I know who won, because it's like watching any other movie. I like to see the story of how did we get there, especially races, you know, where you think of a driver that had to overcome adversity. Maybe he had a botched pit stop, or he's like Bill Elliott in that Talladega race in the mid-80s where he fell two laps down and then drove his ass back to the front, unlapped himself twice to take the win. That to me is just as exciting as waiting there on a Sunday to find out who's going to win that race. It's sometimes more about the journey than it is the destination, to borrow an old phrase.
Exactly. And that's something that I've always loved, is seeing this whole, seeing everything that does happen with those races. Because like you said, you can get there. God, how many races are there that they've ever done? And it's like, yeah, we know this person won and this person won. But then it's like, oh, wait, how did they win? Was it a dominant race? They led every single race or every single lap of that race? Or was it something that, you know, they had won by, you know, coming back from two laps down or whatever? It is such an interesting, you know, thing to do. And even if you don't have time for, you know, all the races or you know, something, there are YouTubers who make, you know, smaller videos, you know, stuff that is 5 to 20 minutes long, and they make some great content, whether it's giving you history behind a certain race team or history of how track was made, or hell, even stories about local lost racetracks. There's a guy I talked about a couple weeks ago called Slap Shoes. He's a local here in Greenville. He has over 70,000 plus on YouTube as subscribers, and he's done so many interesting tracks, you know, lost tracks of NASCAR, including the infamous, you know, the one of the most famous ones, Air Force Base race, Air Force Base track. It's an incredible thing that in this time of non-racing happening, we can still have a lot of stuff, whether it is watching old races that have some iconic moments, like tonight we'll be talking about the 1979 Daytona 500 with some of the most famous words, and they're fighting in the infield. You know, something that captured the eyes of millions up in the New York, New Jersey area. And you know, it does suck that we are in this pandemic, but it's fantastic for people like me who are unemployed and can go back and watch these races and watch all these little knick-knack videos. It's amazing, but sucks at the same time.
It's definitely looking for the silver lining wherever you can find it. I mean, and hell, you don't really have to leave and look at the races if you're looking for good fashion motorsports entertainment. You can even go look at the movies. There's plenty of good racing movies, car movies out there. This past weekend was pretty rainy in Iowa, so I don't know why. It felt like the perfect weekend to just binge all the Fast and the Furious movies, and that's kind of how I spent my weekend, just to get that, you know, that just that extra car fix, you know, that fix of speed. And there's just multiple ways you can find that entertainment, and I feel like the more we focus in on that, hopefully maybe we can find our own ways of coping through this and just kind of hunker down while we're waiting for this all to blow over.
Exactly. And one thing that is cool about, you know, some of those racing movies, there are some that are, if you can find it, you know, online, is Ford v. Ferrari, which is an iconic movie now in my mind, because it shows the story of the iconic legend Carroll Shelby. He never raced in NASCAR, but if it wasn't for him and his performance making amazing cars that aren't just beautiful, but that are fast and that can go out and set records, we don't know how Ford would be in not just the racing world, but in NASCAR, if they would still even try to be in it. That would be my big movie. If you are wanting to watch one, would be my go-to movie for a racing movie right now.
Oh, definitely recommend that. Also, if you've never seen it and you're a NASCAR fan, I have to recommend The Last American Hero. It was loosely based off of NASCAR legend Junior Johnson's life. The full movie is on YouTube. I'm going to say that again. The full movie, for free, is on YouTube. If you have an afternoon, could not recommend higher. It's pure early 70s movie magic. You know, it's a little bit cheesy, serious when it needs to be. The car action sequences are beautifully shot. Jeff Bridges, ironically, the dude himself, plays the lead character, Junior Johnson. Gary Busey's in it. It's a pretty good cast, fantastic fun, and if you're a racing fan, you're going to love it. It's the closest feel that you're going to get to those early 60s, early good old days of racing, and Junior Johnson himself was a lead producer on it, so he had a lot of influence over the look, the feel of it, and so if you've never seen it, could not recommend higher. It was one of the best movies I've seen probably in a good long while. It's just authentic and exactly what you need for a good home feeling on a Saturday night.
Brady, I don't know, man. When I finished my Sunday, I had watched Plan 9 from Outer Space and Bride of the Monster, both by Edward D. Wood Jr., the worst filmmaker of all time. I had pretty good Sunday too, you know.
There you go.
That was comic relief, and nobody. I did it because Ed's daughter Kathy called me up. I'd interviewed her on a show a long time ago, and she was calling to see how Myrtle Beach was doing. So yeah, but you know, there are a lot of great movies, full movies on online now, and so yeah, people should check them out. Just go to YouTube. YouTube doesn't care anymore. They got visitors and people watching these great movies. So yeah, that was back in the day when we actually had a racetrack in Somerville, South Carolina, which is Charleston. So anyway,
I do have to say too, if you are a fan of TV or movies of racing, it's interesting to see how NASCAR drivers have been in movies and TV, and not just like, you know, in the big spotlight, but also just as guest stars. One of the earliest ones I can remember was in Dukes of Hazzard. Cale Yarborough was in two episodes.
Those are some good episodes.
Yes, absolutely.
And I could be wrong. That could be one of the earliest times we've seen a NASCAR driver actually in a film. But it's cool to see that. And I just, when you were talking about watching movies and stuff like that, that was the first thing I thought. I was like, wasn't there a driver in that? And that was back in, I believe, 78, 79.
No, that would have been right around season 3 or 4. So that would have been right around 82, 83.
Oh, you're right. Now I see. Yep, you're right. But that just, like, back in the 80s, having a big NASCAR star like that, Cale Yarborough, one of the, you know, an iconic driver in such an iconic TV classic, and at the time wasn't a classic, it was just what everyone was watching at the time. And it makes me think of like other shows like The Simpsons, and one of my favorites was King of the Hill had a couple of NASCAR drivers and a drag racing star at one point, but they had Dale Earnhardt in an episode on King of the Hill.
That was a good episode too. Also, Zach, I don't know if you remember a little gem of a movie by the name of Looney Tunes Back in Action that came out in 03.
I was just thinking about that one, how Jeff Gordon was in it.
I'm not going to lie, I didn't like it when I was a kid, but a buddy of mine was like, you got to rewatch it as an adult. I was like, okay. So him and I put it on the other week, and I don't know what I missed as a kid, but that had to be one of the arguably funniest movies I'd seen in a long time. And a movie, humor-wise, that was well ahead of its time, because like some of the, like the stylings of the humor, the kind of meta-ness, just the whole feel of the movie felt like it's something that would be released nowadays, with how everything kind of likes to be like a tongue-in-cheek, almost Deadpool-esque kind of a feel to it. Looney Tunes Back in Action was doing that back in 03. I'm like, man, they were ahead of the curve, and we were all just sleeping on it. But if you have a free moment this week, and it's on Netflix, and I couldn't recommend higher. It was one of the funniest things I'd seen in a good while. It was definitely worth a chuckle.
Yeah, that I was thinking about that when I mentioned the Cale Yarborough, but that is something I always thought about was, you know, seeing NASCAR drivers, not just on the TV for racing, but on the TV and the big screen for acting gigs. I think one that was quite funny to me, it was a show, I can't remember what it was, but Brad Keselowski was in it, and it was an Asian American family that owned a bar. And Brad's cameo was he accidentally backed into the star's mom, her car, and it just was a joke on him making left turns and how to pair. And he asked her how to parallel park. And the funny, you know, tongue in cheek thing is that, you know, there's this quote unquote stereotype that Asian people don't know how to drive, and she's an older Asian woman, and she's like, "Oh, you could show me how to parallel park." He goes, "Yeah, if you could show me how to do a couple other things, I could teach them." Like, oh boy. And it's just funny to think of how many different, you know, and it's not even like they're the main star, just, you know, pop-up stuff like that. Golly, now I want to go through and make a list of all the NASCAR stuff that we should put, watch, or all the NASCAR stars and what they were in to watch.
Well, guys, you have missed one of the biggest ones. Dale Earnhardt was in two seasons of Hardee's fast food commercials. He was the star. Do you know about that?
Actually, that's, you bring up a good point, Dr. John. Zach,
yeah.
I don't know if you've kind of stumbled in on this, but YouTube also has a treasure trove of vintage NASCAR commercials.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So thank you for bringing that up, Dr. John, because literally everything from the old Dale Jr. and Michael Waltrip Napa commercials to the old Hardee's commercials that John was referencing,
yep.
Literally almost anything you can think of that had a NASCAR driver in it is on there. There were some really good ones from back in the day. I personally love the Michael Waltrip Dale Jr. Napa commercials, especially when they kind of made it look like a VH1, like, we're going to sell you a bunch of products thing. God, classic television, I'm telling you, folks.
Oh, my goodness, there's McDonald's with Dale Earnhardt in 1991. Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. What is my favorite commercials?
Have you seen it back? But if you have Hulu, I want to watch it, but I've been too scared to watch it, but Jeff Gordon, and I think it was 2003, was the host of Saturday Night Live, and I've never seen it. And they have all the seasons of SNL on Hulu, and I feel like I gotta watch it. I feel like I have to know.
I roughly remember that, and you're right. He was back in 2011, January 11th, 2003. I'm sorry, I was reading the dates backwards. He was the host. And that is such an interesting thing that you literally just pulled that out of nowhere. And, can you take a guess on who the performer for the night was?
Actually, that's a good question. 2003. I want to say Brittany, just because if Jeff was hosting, I know she was the Pepsi girl at the time. Was it Brittany?
Nope, it was Avril Lavigne.
No way.
Oh,
2003.
My goodness.
Okay, yeah, Dip. Fuck, I'm sold. I got to watch that. My girl. I got to watch
that
girl.
That right there is that says racing is now mainstream. When you hit Saturday Night Live, that's it. That really
also
is.
Dale Earnhardt was in the baseball movie written by Trey Parker and Matt Stone, which that was also a hilarious bit part. I'm still surprised to this day they got Dale for that.
Oh, that just reminds me of, like, you know, you talk about getting him for the bit parts. There's two commercials I can think of right off the bat, two drivers, one show. One was in an actual episode. One was in a commercial. That being King of the Hill, I said Dale Earnhardt Sr. was on it. And the funny bit is that in the show, Hank is talking to Bobby, and they're going back and forth, and Bobby goes, like, this is some nice rope. Then you cut to Dale Earnhardt about 5 minutes later. He comes up, and Hank is standing there. Like, look, there's Dale Earnhardt, and he has the whole gang around him. And he says something to Dale, and Dale goes, this is some nice rope. I noticed this earlier when we were unloading the car. And he's just like, it's like him and Bobby are the same person. Wow. And the other one is a is actually a commercial that Daryl Waltrip, not Michael, Daryl did for spark plugs back in the early 2000s, I believe, or late 90s. And
the
it was
Auto
a King of the Hill
one.
Yep, Autolite, that's what it was.
Oh, God. Also, I don't know if you've heard the story, but Dale Jr. was talking about it last year on his podcast. The legendary Days of Thunder movie, apparently Dale Earnhardt was a huge help to the production crew. Like, Tom Cruise met with Dale apparently several times to get his input on racing, how to carry himself, how to, you know, handle the sport, how to really, you know, do a good job. Which, honestly, sidebar, I'm not big on Tom Cruise, but hearing that he put that much emphasis and effort into the racing movie that shaped my childhood definitely earned some brownie points. I was like, okay, Tom Cruise, that's actually really cool. But there's a rumor that allegedly the movie company approached Dale Earnhardt to star in the movie as Rowdy Burns, the infamous character played by Michael Rooker. And as the story apparently goes, Dale Earnhardt politely declined because he didn't want to be the villain of the story. But, you know, the funny thing about that is he was kind of the villain on the track. You know, his nickname was literally Darth Vader with a black helmet and everything. But I don't know. Hearing that story, like, man, what a movie that would have been if Dale Earnhardt had played Dale Earnhardt and just spun out Tom Cruise a bunch of times, you know?
I remember the moment you said Dale Earnhardt Jr. in Days of Thunder, I knew exactly what you're talking about, because that right there, because that does sound like something a movie producer would want. They would want, hey, one of the biggest stars in NASCAR right now, we want you in our movie. And he turns it down. And you know, something else in that story was Tom and the producers were talking to Dale for quite a while. That meeting, trying to convince him to be the actor and to be the big part of that. Golly, now you know what we need to do. We need to do our homework this week and find out what are some of the best movies and TV shows that have NASCAR drivers in it, just so we can have that list for next week.
Oh, yeah. Also, on that docket, if you have a free moment, I highly recommend you watch the 1990 Daytona 500 Speed Weeks coverage. I'm talking the dual races. I'm talking the shootout. I'm talking the 500. Because in that race, during that entire week, they had the movie cars from Days of Thunder participating in the races. They weren't scored. You know, they weren't racing for any of the glory. They were just literally at the back of the track getting some good action sequences. But during the broadcast, you can quite clearly see the 51 Mellow Yellow car, the 46 Sidney Chevrolet car, the 18 Hardys car. I was watching that at work and literally geeking out at my desk. I'm like, oh my God, it's the thing. It's the car. And they have this, and it's all on YouTube because that's how I watched it. The 1995 500, in the pre-race, they do a whole story about it, take you inside for a look at the filming process. And I got to say, it's top-notch entertainment. So if you have a moment, definitely recommend checking that out.
That is one of those. And by the way, do you know who prepped those cars?
Rick Hendrick himself. And I believe Greg Sass was one of the drivers. I'm trying to remember who the other one was.
I can't recall either, but I know you are right on the Greg Sass. And that's something that's never – by the way, that's never going to happen again. We're never going to have movie cars on an active racetrack. They were going a good clip, good speed, but they weren't going the full, you know, 200 miles plus per hour. They were doing, I'd say, about 150 to 140 at most at some point. So this is just
that's
making me want to watch
as good as it did.
I think one big thing was they got those live action shots. They got those, you know, the real cars and everything. You know, if you look back at another one that's interesting is Herbie Fully Loaded, which was a movie of Lindsay Lohan about 10 years ago, 15 years ago?
2000. It was filmed in 2004, came out in 2005.
oh, wow, I was right under that 15 years. Cool. You know, they say that, oh, it's a stock car, so it gets the – no, you are not going to have a little VW bug with a four-cylinder engine on the track with, you know, cars that are twice the size both in engine and in weight. So it was a cool factor that they did with that, with having actual race cars on the track with, and another thing was an actual crowd too. It was having the, you know, the stands full of actual fans, and it was, it's one of those things you'll never catch the actual feel for or the actual appreciation for it.
Also, Zach, this is going to be kind of more personal towards us and our love for the Iowa Speedway, but do you remember back circa 2011 when they were filming some ARCA shots at the Iowa Speedway with a little, you know, no-named actor named Zac Efron and Dennis Quaid, by chance?
That does sound familiar for some reason.
Well, if you get a chance, I actually ended up seeing the movie that those shots were used for. So to help fill our fan audience out there, back in 2011, growing up in Newton, Iowa, a big storm, like a storm of news, started flooding the town about, hey, we're going to be featured in an upcoming Hollywood film. It's going to be taking place at the Iowa Speedway, and Zac Efron's going to be the star. And so I was like, well, cool, sign me up, you know? And so the movie's called At Any Cost, and it's literally about a small-town farmer in Iowa, and his son is trying to leave the family farm because he wants to go racing, while his dad's, you know, trying to do everything he can to save the farm, save the community, and whatnot. It's a really dramatic movie, but the fact that they tied it in to the Iowa Speedway, like all the racing shots were shot during that ARCA weekend, and I'm like, man, I know exactly where each shot is at. I could tell you where they were at for the positioning of that, and it was so cool from that standpoint because it was a track that I know literally like the back of my hand. So I definitely had to recommend that to you, Zach, because I know your affinity and love for the Speedway as well, and I feel like you would really get a kick out of that. It's called At Any Cost, and it's got Dennis Quaid, Heather Graham, and Zac Efron are the three leading actors, three pretty big-name actors, too, for what was a pretty modest-budget movie, honestly.
At any cost or any price?
I believe it was at any cost, but my memory could be spotty
on that. I found
it is
at any price.
Any price? Interesting.
Yes.
Hmm. Maybe
but it's
we'll
close, I mean, yes.
Yeah,
there's another Mandela
yet.
Effect. Mm-hmm.
But yes, I really want to see. Well, here's something funny. On IMDb, it gives a filming credit to DeKalb, Illinois, which is about 4 hours from there. So I think IMDb might want to get that fixed. But that is definitely one that I will have to look up for sure and watch, because that is an interesting one. And like you said, my love for the Iowa Speedway. Golly, 2011. But yeah,
also,
I think though, yeah.
Ooh. Well, I'm going to say, kind of going back to your thought about Cale Yarborough, right around that time, there's also another movie that I have not seen that I'm honestly ashamed to say that I've never seen, but it's a movie by the name of Stroker Ace. And it's got Burt Reynolds in it. It's about Burt Reynolds trying to become a NASCAR driver. And I didn't know this, but apparently a lot of the big drivers of the 80s were in this movie. Guys like Harry Gant made a bit part in it. I think Cale Yarborough showed up. One of the Labonis, I think, made a cameo appearance. Apparently just a whole bunch of drivers guest starred in this movie. And, you know, it's a typical mid-80s Burt Reynolds comedy racing film, you know, in the same vein as Smokey and the Bandit, Cannonball Run, from what I gather. So that right then and of itself has got me sold. But that's one I've always wanted to see, and I'm very ashamed to say I have not gotten around to watching that one.
Well, now you got your homework for this weekend, don't you?
I think so.
And you know, Brady, there's something that you just let us know all about you. You never come to the South, because down here C-A-L-E has two syllables.
Yeah, what?
Kale.
What? Oh,
kale.
Kale. That's
oh, no,
it has two syllables.
I am Yankee through and through. Anyone who listens
to
this podcast could tell you that.
I'm just telling you, you haven't been down here enough, because I didn't know who Cale Yarborough was. But Cale, yeah, we all know who he is.
Mr. Cale Yarborough.
Yeah,
But it's the truth, you know.
Golly. Yeah, he ain't wrong. It's just like a bull peanut, you know.
Exactly. Also, I'm on Brad Keselowski's IMDb page, and I feel like we'd be remiss to not mention the Sharknado 3 that both him and Logano had a guest cameo bit in, and also, of course, one of the greatest movies of all time, Logan Lucky.
Logan Lucky?
Oh, my God. Are you okay, so Logan Lucky came out in 2017. It the whole premise of the movie, it's a heist film where these two brothers, played by Channing Tatum and Adam Driver, are attempting to rob the Charlotte Motor Speedway of all their ticket sales, their souvenir money, and they got Daniel Craig in it, and he's the most non-Daniel Craig in any performance I've ever seen. It's fantastic, but Brad Keselowski has a cameo appearance in it. The whole third act takes place at the Charlotte Motor Speedway. Just a great, great time of a movie.
I remember that now, yep. I've never seen it, but I do remember that, and now looking it up, it brings back memories. And it got some decent reviews and made its money back, so, you know.
Yeah, that's all you got to say there. Also, if you're looking for good biographies, you can't look further than the Dale movie that came out a couple years ago. Just really good look at the life and legacy of Dale Earnhardt. Definitely a must-watch. Also, came out in 2003, the NASCAR IMAX experience. Do you want a really good look into how the sport operates, about the inner workings of the teams? And this is back in 2003, back when the budgets were a little bit smaller than what they are now, but it honestly will give you probably the best look on film of anything you're going to watch, of just how tense the week-in and week-out grind is for these teams, and just how everything comes down to the very last part and how everything needs to work perfectly to win on Sunday. So definitely recommend the NASCAR IMAX experience.
Something interesting about that, I actually did see it in the IMAX.
Oh, lucky. I did not see it in IMAX. I've only watched it on DVD.
Yeah, it was interesting because I remember at one point there's a tire that comes off and it's bouncing and you hear the boing, boing, and it comes right at you at the screen. You're wearing the 3D glasses like,
that would have been so, so cool.
It was. But, okay, so I think we got enough of some nerd fun out. And by the way, we will, me and Brady and Dr. John will talk about this tomorrow. We'll make we'll have our own assignments on some of our favorite racing movies, our favorite racing cameos in movies, on TV shows, and even on like commercials. We'll make a list of some of our favorites for next week. How does that sound?
That sounds perfect to me.
Well, I'm going to take the commercials with the two guys with four-letter names that have two syllables, because it was Kale and there was Dale, right? There was.
You can't go wrong with that.
Kale and Dale. And we didn't know that wasn't how you pronounced them. They didn't either. You can pronounce your name any way you want, but he was Dale. That's two syllables, boys. There is no one syllable word in the South. There is no one syllable word in the South. So, and I'm from the South. I can say that, you know.
What do you got there? It's my Dale call.
Dale.
Oh God, that thing was funny. But I feel like we need to get to, because we didn't get to last week because we had the fantastic Todd on. That was a hoot and a holler, and actually a cool thing that we got to talk to him about the race, you know, him growing up and watching racing to how different it is. But that's one thing we didn't get to jump to, was the 1979 Daytona 500. I rewatched it again today. Golly, it is such a great race.
Did the outcome change? Zach, did the outcome change? It didn't? Oh, okay.
No. Almost 41 years later, still hasn't changed.
Okay, I was just checking. I didn't get the laughter that I expected. Okay.
I don't know, I got the laughter. But Brady, you've watched that race. I'm going to assume you've watched that race more than a dozen times, just in general.
Actually, Sadly, I watched it for the first time this last off season. I've only seen it the twice now.
What?
Oh, Brady.
Yeah. No, it was actually my mission for the off season. I've always wanted to, and I just never really had the time or the resources growing up. But this is the first time I had time and good fast internet, so it became my mission this off season to start watching every single Daytona 500. I started with 1979, the first flag to flag broadcast, and worked my way on through. And I got to tell you, I do not regret it, because the storylines that you learn from watching the Daytona race, just the stars that I would see, and just watching the sport literally evolve in front of my eyes. It was one of the best things educationally I've ever done to try and learn more about the sport. So, this was my first year watching the 79 500, and I instantly regretted it when it was over, because I'm like, man, all these years I could have literally watched a masterpiece in motion, and I missed out.
Well, if you don't know why we chose the 1979 Daytona 500, it's one of the more historical races. It still had Richard Petty win it, but not a lot of people know it for that. The big reason people know it, especially up in the north, like I said, in the New York, New Jersey, Washington, D.C., really up in that area, there was a big blizzard that came through that year, and it snowed in a lot of people. And if you're like me and Brady, we're fairly young. We're used to having, 60, 70, 80 channels to watch. But back then, there was only about 3 to 4 to 5, depending on your area. And so the only things that were on was the Daytona 500 and tennis. Well, most people that didn't want to watch tennis watched the fantastic Great American Race, the Daytona 500, which had racing action from start to finish. They started under yellow because, it had rained there, and they were determined to get the race in. They had about 15 laps of caution to try to dry out the track enough to get a racing condition going. And after that green flag finally dropped on lap 15, it was like all hell broke loose. Everything from a lot of engines overheating to the pole sitter having an engine issue, a lot of engine problems with this race. But we had a driver, a young man, making his first Daytona 500 appearance. I think his name's Dale Earnhardt.
Dale.
Even go
That's
up
right,
there and lead laps. Like, this race is just historical for everything. I mean, it has everything from Richard Petty winning, had another legend, Dale Earnhardt, making his first 500 appearance, and had one of the most famous lines up to date in there called, "They're fighting," yelling across the broadcast, "They're fighting in the infield," when the two lead cars coming out of turns three or coming out of turns one and two, Donnie Allison and Cale Yarborough, tangled up on the backstretch, beating, banging, hit the wall. And after Richard Petty got that checkered flag, it's not like it was over. The action was just starting. They both get out of their cars, personnel's all coming around, and man, if helmets didn't come off and punches didn't start flying. After that race, there was more want for NASCAR races on TV by the public, by the normal Joe Schmoes like you and me and Brady and John. It was nuts to see the evolution of NASCAR happen. I feel a big one happened at that race that day.
And honestly, kind of breaking down into the racing action, you kind of alluded to it. Everyone knows this race for the big fight between Donnie Allison and Cale Yarborough. But what really stood out to me, and something that I did not know about this race, is the very first caution flag that flew on lap 31 was for those two, and also Donnie's brother Bobby getting into a wreck off of turn two. Like, I was like, wait a minute, whoa. It's kind of going back to our talk earlier about how it's a lot of fun to kind of see how the storylines, unfold to a race, not only just seeing who won it, but also seeing how did we get there. Because literally from lap 31, I'm like, okay, these guys are in the grass. They're trashed. How the hell do they make their way back up to duke it out for the lead? So right there, instantly, I was hooked. I'm like, okay, now I got to really pay attention. How did they get their way back up there? Because back in the day, there weren't any free passes. There weren't any lucky dogs. There weren't any wave arounds. If you fell a lap down, you had to earn that lap back. And it was so amazing watching these
masters of the draft, Cale Yarbrough especially, he perfected the old slingshot, or for some of you Hollywood fans out there, the old shake and bake. Just watching him just lay in the weeds like a cougar waiting to pounce, you know. It was just masterful poetry in motion. But right there, right on lap 31, I was instantly hooked. I'm like, okay, I know these guys are going to factor into the finish. I know Richard Petty wins this. But how the hell do we go from our main two leading actors in the story going from spinning in the grass to the lead? So right there, I was hooked. And also kind of looking down this this leaderboard, Zach, you brought it up. Back in the late 70s and early 80s, and I noticed this a lot when I was watching the early 500s, mechanical issues were very, very prevalent in NASCAR, because back then they were just tuning these cars to the absolute ragged edge, trying to find every ounce of speed. And anyone out there tuning wrenches knows the more you push that edge, the more likely you are for a failure. And looking at this entry list, there was 41 cars that started that race. 21 of them fell out with some sort of either engine-related issue, mechanical issue of some kind. I see suspension, engine, brakes, transmission, clutch, you name it, a lot of mechanical failures. And that was just how things were, because you didn't have the precision and the big budgets that teams have nowadays. And so literally teams were just scraping for every last bit of edge they could. And the other thing I'm looking at, this finishing order, and I want to get your thought on this, Zach, just looking at the vast array of manufacturers, I see Oldsmobile on this list, Buick, Chevrolet, that's three makes from the GM umbrella. There's Dodge on this list. There's Ford. Ford had Mercury and Ford in this. I'm just looking at this, and that's the part I feel like I miss a lot about some of these older days of racing, is that there was not just three manufacturers. There was a whole plethora of manufacturers you could cheer for. And I really hope that one day we can see that again, where it's not just Chevy, Ford, and Toyota, that we might see a Dodge back in the sport one day. Or maybe we could get an Oldsmobile back, or heck, maybe even a Beamer or an Audi or something. But that diversity was what also made that race really compelling to me.
That was something that I do miss, because it's been up until recently, really, in this about 10 years ago, close to 17 years ago, NASCAR still had multiple manufacturers, including Dodge and Pontiac. It is odd not to see them in the sport anymore, growing up watching them. But that is something that I do love is seeing, because the top five are all Buick, or not Buicks, are all Oldsmobile. Then it's Buick, then Chevy, and then you get something that's not in the GM umbrella, which is Dodge. And it's so cool to see. And the top dog, you know, was an Oldsmobile, but it wasn't, you know, like anyone we didn't know. It was Richard Petty running an Oldsmobile. He wasn't running Dodge. He wasn't running Ford. He was back. He was in the GM camp that year.
And actually, that was the very, very beginning of Richard Petty kind of straying away from the Chrysler group, because right towards the late 70s, Dodge, you know, they were struggling. They weren't finding the same edge that they had in the 60s with those Plymouth Superbirds or those Dodge Daytonas. That edge was kind of gone. NASCAR had kind of taken away some of their legs up on the group by, you know, restricting the Hemi, bogging down their all-out horsepower Mopars, and eventually the point where Richard Petty is like, I can't compete in a Chrysler product, and he went the way of those sleek-looking Oldsmobiles, which I got to say, they're kind of an odd-looking car, but I really like the look of them Oldsmobiles.
Oh, yeah, they were good-looking cars. And if you just look at that list, too, you know, the top five all led laps. They led of a combined 116 laps combined of this race. 116. All one manufacturer. All the top five. We don't see that often anymore.
No, not really. And one name that really stands out to me on this list, and it was a name that popped up a lot during my off-season watching the 500s, and a driver that I really didn't quite understand his history, and I've really done a lot of research since watching these 500s to try and learn more about him, but it's A.J. Foyt. I didn't realize just how big a name A.J. Foyt was. I mean, obviously I grew up hearing that name a lot, but I really never was taught about
just the legacy that he had and just how versatile a driver he was and just honestly what an overall badass he was. And seeing him kind of duck in and out in that bright orange 51 Gilmore car, I'm like, man, I know you don't win this, but go for it. I'm hoping that maybe my history book is wrong and that you somehow pulled us off.
AJ Foyt is definitely a driver's driver. He could wheel anything and everything. He's won big historical races and even won something called the Indy 500, something special like that.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Some little small town Saturday night showdown, I think, you know.
But it's definitely, back then too, it wasn't uncommon to see open wheel drivers race these, you know, racing stock cars, race at the historical tracks like Daytona and Talladega. It was, it wasn't something different. It was racing. To them, if they could sit behind the wheel and race, by golly, they're going to do it. And by golly, did they win? You know, Mario Andretti, AJ Foyt, just a couple big names in IndyCar. AJ Foyt and Mario Andretti owning teams in IndyCar still. And they themselves winning the Indy 500 one or two times. It is fascinating. If you look at that too, he didn't get any points because he wasn't running for points. He was just running to run the race. It's kind of like some of those, like Jamie McMurray last year who made his last Daytona 500 starts. You know, it was kind of just like a race he wanted to do and try to win.
And honestly, that kind of brings up something I want to talk about. The 79 500 to me really serves as the last major stock car race that occurred in my view, like the pre-modernized NASCAR that you and I grew up in. Because if you fast forward 10 years from this race, the 1989 500, that field looks completely different. And the biggest difference I see is the sponsorship game. 79 and like the early 80s was right around the time when big Fortune 500 companies started seeing the value in NASCAR. And a lot of that value came from just the TV ratings generated by this race and the overall buzz generated by this race. And that's when you start seeing more sponsors kind of fill in the sides of these cars, more sponsors trying to get drivers to commit to the full season. And kind of as the sponsors took over and really had more demands about what they wanted their drivers to do, you started to see less and less the drivers crossing genres, quote unquote. You know, you started seeing less of the AJ Foyts, you know, dabbling in Indy, but then going to run the 500 because back then they weren't, you know, at the mercy of a sponsor telling them they had to run the full season. They could literally run the races they wanted, run the cars that they wanted. And to me, that's kind of an interesting shift in the business model of the sport that I feel like takes place with the 79 500. And also just kind of looking down that list of the finishing order, you see some big names that have, you know, that started back with this race that have become longtime associations of the sport. Sponsors like Busch Beer on Cale Yarborough's car, Gatorade on Darrell Waltrip's car, or even all the way down at the bottom of the pack, Valvoline, one of the biggest, most loved sponsors. Burger King's on this list. Sponsors that would, you know, throw a few bucks at these teams back then, but have turned that into a lifelong partnership with the sport. And so there's two kind of angles that have really interested me from the sponsorship standpoint on this race.
Well, it is interesting because we, like you said, sponsorship back then, and if you look at Richard Petty's car, he didn't have a sponsor on the hood. It was blank. He didn't have as many decals or the big sponsorship. You know, STP was on there, but it wasn't the main focus. It wasn't the main sponsor. It was really the only sponsor. And I feel that, you know, like I said, in 1979, there was a big blizzard that came through the Northeast that really locked people in. And I feel like that was one big thing that helped was a lot of sponsors seeing what was going on. And then over the years of the evolution of NASCAR, seeing, okay, well, there's quite a lot of people that are still watching this. It is good because it did bring in more money for these teams to do what they wanted, to build these cars even faster, even better. But it did change, you know, that crossover. We don't get to see, like you said, the IndyCar guys much, you know, even though, yes, we do have some drivers who will go back, like Kurt Busch a few years ago, drove for the Indy 500 and the Coke 600 in the same day, but we don't see that often anymore.
Exactly. And one other thing about the broadcast in particular that really stood out to me, that really endears me toward these older broadcasts and really, I think, made the storyline super compelling, was the broadcaster spent equal time talking about the men driving the cars, but they shone a lot of light on the head mechanics that were turning the wrenches on these cars. I learned so much from those broadcasts about head wrenches like Dale Inman, Waddell Wilson, just these names that were names to me before, but watching these races, I could see just how these pioneers of the sport were really instrumental and were almost kind of superstars in their own rights. Back then, you didn't want to drive the car with the biggest sponsor. You wanted to drive the Waddell Wilson 28 because you knew that he was going to turn those wrenches better than anyone and give you the fastest car for Daytona. Or you wanted to work for Petty and the Dale Inman crew because you knew there was no one with more experience turning those wrenches. Or you wanted a Banjo Matthews chassis or a Robert Gee car, you know, just all these names, these head wrenches that were getting so much media time back on these old broadcasts. Like, that was something that really stood out to me and was something I kind of miss about our sport nowadays. You know, we hear about the crew chiefs, but they're not put in that same light, I feel like, as they were back then when they were the head wrenches and really the biggest draws for, you know, building the top teams back then, you know?
Well, the cars were different. You know, those were cars. Today we have they drive a computer. That's what it is. Yeah, that's.
Well, I think what, you know, what Brady's trying to say, John, is not just the computer part. It's actual the chassis and the analytics of actually, you know, fuel economy and how the tire wears. And I understand that, Brady, and I truly miss it too, especially as someone that has worked in those shops, has worked with, you know, those people. It is a thing I do miss. They do sometimes do something like that, but now everything is such, you know, secret, hush. It's hard to for them to actually do that stuff, but it is cool that you get that highlight of, you know, talking about the crew, not just the crew chief, but the crew behind that car and how they built it at the shop. I mean, you know, talking about it, they had those little excerpts during the race where they showed actual footage of them working on cars back in the shop, not there in Daytona, but they're in the shops. And there was a few that there was some snow on the ground. And it's just like, it just makes me think, you know, how many teams back then were racing out of shops that weren't in the Mooresville area. You know, there's only a couple left in the top tier division of the trucks, Xfinity and Cup level that don't run out of the Charlotte area, you know, Charlotte, Mooresville, Huntersville, Statesville area. But I will say it is fantastic we have that because there isn't, you know, we don't have like the social media. They didn't have social media where, you know, people could post photos or videos of what they can do. You know, it's cool that we have that because we can see what all they were able to do back then and not worry about, you know, team secrets. You know, it was like 2 or 3 weeks after it's like, oh, they do this, huh? Now it's just, it's too hush for that, but I do love it because you get to see where these teams work, how they work, and what they're doing to the bodies or the chassis or the motors.
And also back then, the sport itself has kind of almost to the point gotten to being a strictly almost spec series. And, you know, from a racing competition standpoint, that's fantastic because if you want your sport to be about the drivers and you want to showcase who has the best drivers, I mean, easily the best way to do that is to try and make the cars as equal as possible. And while that's led to some really good racing, the thing that I feel like is kind of gone and these old broadcasts are really making me miss is the creativity and just how when you built a car that you put to Daytona, yes, you had to meet the NASCAR rules and you had to make sure it fit the templates, but you were putting on your work of art. Like, that was a custom piece by your head engineer, and it was his signature that was all over that car. And that's what really stood out to me about those broadcasts was the cars themselves were the star. And the real Michelangelos of the sport, the ones that could really fine-tune the finer lines, massage the aerodynamics of the car, really tune those engines to get every ounce of speed out of them, that to me was, even though the racing could be won by laps sometimes or by seconds advantage, yeah, it's not cool from a competition standpoint, but just from an overall, like, engineering standpoint, I was just in awe watching these machines just be really pushing every bit to the edge that they could to try and get every ounce of speed all the way up through the 80s when you were seeing speed records broken, drivers and teams striving to hit that 200-mile-per-hour mark. It was fascinating, you know, and growing up in the sport that I did, where everything was super close, everything was super regulated, and it kind of came down to the drivers, I do really enjoy the racing we get nowadays, and that it kind of becomes like a true almost gladiator test of who's the strongest racer out there. But I don't know, there's something to be said about that creativity that's missing from the sport, and that individualism that was tailored to each and every race car that made them each and individually special. And I feel like that's kind of where the car itself is no longer the star of the show almost. And I'm kind of torn on that. I kind of miss that being something that you could see, because it was really interesting, especially this race in particular, where you were seeing all kinds of cars and different mechanics being mentioned. So I don't know, that was something that really, it's really been sticking with me since watching these old races.
I understand that. And I love it too. It's just one of those things. It's kind of like F1, and I know our good friend Greg would agree with me on this probably, you know, the evolution of technology to make a car go faster and be safer will take priority over some stuff. But I still love this race. It's a fantastic blossom in the sport because of the fact you had so many fantastic names that some were even running up to, you know, the early 2000s, like Ricky Rudd was still running back just a handful of years ago. And you still have people like Terry Labonte as well, who was running quite a few years ago. But you have Richard Childress, who, you know, is running his own team and having, you know, Dale Earnhardt as his driver for many of years. Just looking at the list and seeing all these names and seeing everyone, it's just truly amazing to see what and who all we had and seeing just what was. And if you look too, there's quite a few cars that didn't qualify. There's so many that withdrew or didn't make it through the heat race. I'm looking at it and it's almost a full page, and there's some names on there like Jimmy Means, who didn't make the race, James Hilton, who, you know, was a big staple in ARCA until he tragically lost his life just a couple of years ago. It's man, the list of just how many drivers didn't make the race, and we don't see that either. Seeing almost, I'd say, 20-some cars that didn't even make the race on this. We maybe have one or two, like this year's Daytona 500. We only had two drivers not make the race. It's just an odd thing to see all these cars, but yet we only had a few that, or we only get a few now that may not make a race.
And also one thing that's also kind of interesting about where this stands in history is 1979 fully, I think in my mind at least, was the close of the Richard Petty era of NASCAR, the era that the sport was dominated by its king. This was the year he won his seventh and final Daytona 500. And he ended the season winning his seventh and final championship as well. He edged out Darrell Waltrip by 11 points to win the 79 championship, which 11 points is a scant margin by today's standards. But back then, points were awarded, I think, like 3 or 4, 5 points per position, not the 1 point per position format that we have nowadays. So an 11-point margin back then was literally the difference of maybe 1 or 2 positions on the track, just stupid close. For the old form of keeping track of the points. And if you look at the point standings following the 500, Darrell Waltrip was the leader because back then the 500 was not the opening race of the season. They ran a couple races at Riverside before going to Daytona. So Waltrip had already had the point lead heading into Daytona, and he left with a 30-point advantage over Cale Yarborough. Donnie Eielson left there 35 points back, and then Richard Petty, who would end up claiming the championship, he was sitting fourth, 113 points back, leaving the 500. And then those same drivers would be your top four. Bobby Allison, at season's end, would hold on to the third place in points, and Cale Yarborough would hold on for fourth. So that was also kind of interesting to see that
really Richard Petty's run at his historic seventh and final championship that really solidified his position as NASCAR's king started right here in the sandy beaches of Daytona, where he was the master. No one in history has ever gotten close, and I don't think anyone will ever get close to Petty's mark of winning seven 500s, because that race was one of the toughest races back then, and it arguably is one of the toughest races now to win, because you just don't know what can happen on those high banks. Literally, the smallest mistake back then of a parts failure, or the smallest mistake today in the packs, where you just accidentally bump off a guy's bumper, could completely ruin your race. And I think that is something that has stood the test of time, the different technologies, and that's what's always made Daytona special, and what's always made Daytona, Daytona. It's the track that truly pushes car drivers and teams to their absolute limits, and it's something that, as a proud tradition, that continues on today.
I think one huge thing, and I truly mean this, that helped this sport was not just the race, but the fight at the end. Because not a lot of people realize Richard Petty won that. A lot of people quote that race because of the famous words Ken Squire said, there's a fight in the infield.
Oh, yeah, my boy Squire. And it was honestly kind of funny. I've heard multiple interviews where Donnie and Kaylee Yarborough have talked about it, you know, many decades later. And the funny thing was about the whole incident, what really set off the fight was not the actual crash itself. I mean, obviously they were ticked off that they'd lost. But what sent Kale over the edge was Bobby had stopped at the inside of the track and offered Donnie a lift back to the garage, and he was going to leave just Kaylee Yarborough sitting there in the infield, and that's what pissed Kaylee Yarborough off and what caused him to swing his helmet in the first place, because he didn't swing it at Donnie, the driver he crashed with. He swung his helmet at Bobby Allison. So that, to me, I think is the funniest thing about that whole fight was, it had nothing to do with the wreck itself. It had to do with an earlier incident where they took each other out and Bobby refusing to give Kale a lift back to the garage.
And it is such a, like I said, it truly is an iconic race because of a bunch of things. One of the lowest ones is that Richard Petty won his seventh Daytona 500. Another thing is, it was the first televised live race ever. There was never a live race. It was always a race recap, or it was televised later on with, you know, commentary added during the week. Ken Squire actually talked about that on Dale Jr.'s podcast, and which is a fantastic listen to hear him talk about that. The fact that they even started this race because of the heavy rains they had and the uncertainty of the track. They also had a live in-car camera that was back then not heard of much. It's not like today where the camera could legitimately fit inside your hand and it broadcasts in 4K with audio and everything. No, this was a huge camera that was strapped in and given live footage of the track, of what the drivers were doing. But I feel the big kicker for this race is always going to be that fight, because it is the thing that people would then tune into then the week after, because that's what they were hoping for, was another fight.
Well, and fun fact, honestly, about the start of the race you kind of mentioned there. Do you know why they were so determined to get the start of the race on time, and why they ran those first 15 laps under a green yellow situation rather than waiting for the track to dry?
They wanted to stay in that time frame, I believe, right?
Yeah, because they had a strict contract with CBS, who was broadcasting the race, that if they did not get the green flag, that was in the clause, if they did not get the green flag on time, that CBS would cut to something else. So Bill France, in a last-ditch effort, he got the race under a green flag, because there was nothing in the contract that said it couldn't be a green-yellow start. So that was the way that they were able to keep the CBS deal together, because rain almost ended up costing them that big, lucrative live broadcast that ended up putting the sport on the map. So a really heads-up business move by Big Bill to keep the sport relevant and to make a gamble on this race, because it paid off handsomely for the sport.
And one other thing I want to say before we kind of wrap up for the night is I
and
love
I've got a,
how they
I've got a statement to make too. All right,
give me 1 second. I'll get you to that. One thing I love to see was Bill France right in the booth with a camera, headphones, and everything, and he would flip the switch to kill the caution lights. I would love to see that back in action today.
Oh, yeah. What did you got for us, Dr. John?
Okay, in 1979, everybody wanted to see another fight. If there was a fight today like that, how different would it be? Just think.
With Twitter, Facebook, and everything, probably
yep.
a lot better. Probably be pretty funny.
Well, also, one thing I want to mention before we put the close on the 79500, you touched on it briefly, but the in-car camera shots, I don't know what it was about those early in-car camera shots where they literally put a physical stand-up, you know, bulky camera in the passenger seat that made it feel like you were, you know, hunkered down in the passenger seat right there with them. Like, we've seen onboard technology my entire life of watching the sport, your life too, Zach. And I don't know, something about the feel of watching those early in-car camera shots, something about it just felt different. It felt made me feel more like I was actually in the car. And I don't know why the camera technology, as it's gotten better, has lost that feel, because I've watched countless in-car audio, in-car video shots from today's races or from the early 2000s, and they don't capture that same, like, I'm sitting in the floorboard feel. And I feel like that has a lot to it being literally, the camera was literally almost a human-sized passenger sitting right there next to the driver. So that to me was something that was really interesting about those early attempts at in-car camera shots, and something that was kind of cool and something I don't feel like it's the same nowadays, you know?
I definitely feel you on that. And maybe they'll change some cameras that they have before. They put gyro cameras. Maybe we'll get something different soon, but only time will tell. So we got to kind of wrap up. We got 3 minutes. We have our race rewind that we need to tell you which race to watch. Brady, what race was that again?
I believe we're up to the 2007 Food City 500 at Bristol, aren't we?
Yes, we are, because we're going to do Dale Earnhardt's the week after the Daytona 500. So we're going to be watching the 2007 Food City 500. What was the full name of that race for everyone?
That is the full name, the Food City 500 at Bristol Motor Speedway. And the reason we picked this race, ladies and gentlemen, to kind of bring it relevant to 2020, is this was the very first race of the Car of Tomorrow. And obviously, with everything going on, the launch of the next-gen car has been pushed back. But with all the buzz around the next-gen car about, you know, going to be the brand-new car that we're going to race week in and week out, I wanted to take us back to this particular point in time, one of the last major shifts in the look of the car, a major overhaul of the appearance of the car, the racing of the car, kind of occurred with this 07 race. And it's a very entertaining race, too. I know the Car of Tomorrow gets a lot of slack and a lot of bad mouthing for how it looked, but the overall racing project, especially in those early races, was really good. So that's your homework assignment for this week, ladies and gentlemen, is to watch this race. And we're going to kind of discuss it next week and kind of talk about the lasting impact and the legacy of the boxcar, the Car of Tomorrow.
Yes.
All right.
Be fun.
Well, guys, it's been great. It's been a lot of fun. It's made our nights a lot better to get to talk about the Charlotte line. So, look, thanks a lot for being here. Be safe. Don't get sick on us. And we'll see you next week, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, 9 p.m. Central. And I don't know what time it'll be in London, but we'll be here. Have a good one.
We got people in London.
Good night, everyone.
Awesome.
Bye,
y'all. Oh, I think we have
Kale and Dale.
We have Kale and Dale. That's right.
Praise Dale. I have
Dale.
A dyslexic.
Praise Dale. Praise Dale.